Our major concern is this virus going to continue to evolve and adapt, making it easier to transmit between mammals?
That's Dr. Fred Gingrich with the American Association of Bovine Practitioners. My guest today as we discuss the influenza type A H5N1, or otherwise known as bird flu outbreak, that's now being confirmed in dairy cattle. As a beef cattle rancher, I have a lot, and I mean a lot of questions, like, are beef cows susceptible? What are the symptoms? How is it transferred? Is it fatal?
The good news in all of this is that it doesn't kill cows.
Plus, concerns as to what will this do to consumer confidence of any products that come from cows? And then what about the traceability topic?
This disease outbreak is a warning sign to our industry that we have got to have a very robust traceability system.
And finally, what if we see it in a beef cow? Dr. Gingrich rates this issue at a level of 8.5 to 9 on a scale of 10. For the sake of your ranch and our cattle industry, tune in for today's episode of the Working Ranch Radio Show. Hi everyone, Justin Mills, your host of the Working Ranch Radio Show. Thanks for joining us here on our program. As you heard there in the opening, yeah, we're going to be getting into the nitty-gritty details of this bird flu outbreak in dairy cattle that we're seeing, and a lot of questions I have as a beef cattle rancher. I'm sure if I have questions like this, I'm betting you do too, and I think we're going to get to an awful lot of those questions today, so be sure to tune in on that. Do want to mention just a couple things. We do have a bonus segment here today. We're going to be talking with Dr. Karen Davison with Purina about horse nutrition. Yeah, it's that time of the year. We're starting to ride these horses quite a bit more than we were during the winter months. What do we need to be looking at for nutrition for our horses? So be sure to tune in for that. Want to also mention that I got a note here from my friends at the Montana Cattle Women Association. They're actually hosting this year's American National Cattlewomen's Wired Conference. That'll be taking place June 7th and 8th in Columbus, Montana. A lot of great topics are going to be covering during that conference. If you're interested in attending, you can go to the website at ancw.org/wired or just search up American National Cattlewomen as well. Well, let's jump right into our subject here today because we do have a lot to cover. Joining us is Dr. Fred Gingrich, who is the Executive Director for the American Association of Bovine Practitioners. And Dr. Gingrich, thanks for joining us here today on the Working Ranch Radio Show.
Happy to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
The timeliness of our conversation is going to be very applicable because a lot of stuff is happening right now is what we're with our main subject here today. To start from the top and maybe work down through this subject, if we can, I don't know any other better way to maybe do that, because there's a lot of fingers around this subject as well. And I think for beef ranchers, there's some concern. We know we've heard of this in the dairy industry, but brief explanation about the H5N1 virus, how it's evolved from bird flu now into dairy cattle that we're seeing.
Yeah. So the dairy cattle disease outbreak they've discovered on March 25th, the USDA announced that the cause of the illness in dairy cattle is avian influenza type A, H5N1, otherwise known as high path AI in birds. That has been around for many years. It's a global disease that's affecting many animals, but primarily it causes death in birds. And in 2022, it got into the poultry flocks in the U.S. and they've had to depopulate a lot of birds. So that initial spillover event occurred in Texas, and multiple dairies have been affected, and now it is spreading to other regions of the country. Currently, there are 9 states that have confirmed cases. Right now, only dairy cows, only lactating dairy cows appear to have the disease.
Mm-hmm. You had said that it's been around for a while. So why now? I mean, what's making it happen that we're seeing it evolve into lactating dairy cows that we're aware of right now?
This virus, unfortunately, has a history of changing and evolving, and this influenza virus, when it does change and evolves, it starts jumping into other species. There's been over 200 mammalian cases. This is just the first time it has infected cows. And the concern there, of course, is, you know, our major concern is this virus going to continue to evolve and adapt, making it easier to transmit between mammals. That would be our major concern.
Mm-hmm. What other mammals besides dairy cows is it in now? I'd heard like cats. Is there some other stuff that we've seen it in as well?
Yeah. So, farm cats have been affected, and there's been some mortalities there. There was a case last month in a goat in Minnesota, but globally, it has infected, seals and sea lions, dolphins, many different mammalian species around the world.
Mm-hmm. So then from a management and control point of view, what kind of options do we have?
Well, control is kind of difficult right now just because we're not 100% sure how it's transmitted between cows. Initially, we didn't think it was going to spread between cows. It was just going to be birds to cows. There's evidence now that it is spreading between cows. So, control is going to focus on two things. Number one, bird control. And controlling birds on dairies is about as easy as controlling it on a ranch.
Yeah.
Which means I don't know how you do that, but, we certainly on dairy farms have a little bit of the ability to deter birds, interrupt nesting places, noise deterrence, things of that nature. But, every dairy farmer knows that those birds love that free corn. And so they collect on farms and then they defecate in the waterers and on the feed. So controlling birds as best we can is one point of focus. And then the other point of focus is controlling the movement of cows onto dairies. And I'm sure we're going to talk about that a little bit, but certainly if a cow has the disease and that cow goes onto a farm that does not have the disease, that's certainly a way that we introduce diseases. And that is the case for dairy farms, beef farms, and swine and poultry operations. So animal movements and bird control is where we have to focus our prevention efforts right now.
Okay, so real quick, rudimentary question for me to ask. When you talk about birds, we're assuming pretty much any kind of bird, but is there specific birds? Are we talking pigeons, sparrows? Is there specific birds or just kind of birds in general?
The natural host for this virus is waterfowl, but it is in grackles and starlings and pigeons and all the birds that we see on dairy farms. The natural host is waterfowl, and they're the ones that initially spread it years ago, and then it's gotten into many other bird species since.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So when we look at the dairy side of things, you had said that it's with these lactating dairy cows. Is that one of the keys in this? Lactating, I guess, is what I'm coming back to. Is that the key not only with dairy, but then other animals?
So in dairy cattle, it appears that this virus has what we call a tropism or an affinity for the udder. And the virus, that is where we detect it at very, very high levels. The diagnosticians are surprised at how much virus is actually in the milk of those cows and in the udder. In other species, it's an influenza virus. So it affects the respiratory system. So in birds, it affects the respiratory system and the gastrointestinal tract. But we're not really finding that in cows, and we don't know why. That's probably fortunate because the good news in all of this is that it doesn't kill cows, and it doesn't even spread through the whole herd like it does in birds going through the entire flock. It affects about 10 to 15% of the animals in those herds, and it doesn't kill any of them, but it does concentrate in the udder. That is a concern for our ranchers because certainly if this was identified in beef cattle, and right now it has not been. There have been no cases reported. There's been a little bit of surveillance testing done in beef cattle, no positive tests. That's fortunate because we all know the disaster it would be if it was in beef cattle and they dried up in milk. That's a major problem for our ranchers. And so we're watching that, but fortunately right now it does not appear to be in the nation's beef herd.
Okay. As you were talking about that, the thought that was going through my head is a pretty good majority or chunk of our nation's beef herd calves in the spring, which is when these cows are heavy lactating. Does that give you any pause for concern at all?
Well, it did initially because I was really concerned because certainly where did this disease outbreak start? It started in Texas. And so, I was immediately concerned. Oh my goodness, it's March going into April, and wow. But I'm less concerned now because, boy, you know, this is spreading and we haven't heard of any of it being in beef cattle, and where it has been from going to Texas up into the middle of the country, you know, Kansas and other places, Colorado. Certainly, I think that we would have heard it being affecting beef herds by now if it was going to affect it. Mm-hmm. We still need to be on alert, and ranchers still need to, you know, if I was a rancher, I would certainly be just making sure and checking my cows and my pears and making sure that everything looked okay, which they do. So, but haven't heard anything.
Mm-hmm. Okay. A couple thoughts that I was thinking about as you were saying that, and we'll get to the other one, but you just said as ranchers, you know, something we need to be looking for. What do we need to be looking for? As you were talking about, is that cows drying up? Is that essentially it? What else do we need to be looking for?
Well, what we see in dairy cows is they quit eating. So that's going to be tough to detect on a mama cow. They quit eating, they quit ruminating. And then what happens is that they basically quit producing milk, and the milk turns almost a colostrum like yellow thick substance. So if I was a rancher, I'd be looking for slack bag cows or ballin' calves that are hungry or, you know, look skinny and sick, because if that mom quits making milk, certainly the calf is going to be sick almost immediately. And that's something that they just need to watch for.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One other thing is, we were talking about it starting in Texas, moving up, and we see it now confirmed into Colorado. Does weather have anything to do with this? I mean, I know we have some migration of birds, probably, maybe that's the weather tie-in. I don't know. Just a quick question here I had in regards to weather or time of the year.
We don't know that, and there's a lot we don't know right now, Justin. There are herds that have been affected that brought in lactating animals, and there are herds that have been affected that have not. And so I think mode of transmission is either going to be birds or cows for any of those. Does weather play a role? Certainly with the migration pattern of birds, that would be the role that potentially weather could play.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's take a break here. When we come back, we're going to continue on. We've got a lot more to talk about this. We're talking about the influenza A H5N1 virus that's migrating into, has been confirmed into dairy cattle and the dairy herd. My guest today is Dr. Fred Gingrich. He's the executive director of the American Association of Bovine Practitioners. We've got more to talk about, as we're also going to get into other ramifications that this is all going to, what we're seeing in the industry and what that's going to look like as we move forward in this. We're going to continue when we come back here on the Working Ranch Radio Show. This segment today brought to you by Inherent Select from Zoetis. Don't miss your chance to save on genetic testing. Unlocking genetic potential starts with a complete picture of your commercial cow herd. Learn how to get started with Inherent Select at beefgenetics.com/radio. We'll be back after this.
What if your commercial beef herd could be better than you thought possible? Genetic testing can help give you more confidence about what your herd is made of, and more importantly, what it can be. Inherent Select from Zoetis provides data-driven genetic insights to help you make more informed selection, breeding, and culling decisions about your cows and heifers. The journey from genetic potential to reality begins with Inherent Select. Ask a genetics rep how to save on testing with our whole herd promotion. Go to beefgenetics.com/radio.
Welcome back to the Working Ranch Radio Show. My guest today is Dr. Fred Gingrich. He is the executive director of the American Association of Bovine Practitioners, as we are looking at the implications and our subject today at the influenza A H5N1, essentially bird flu that's now being transferred into, that we're seeing it showing up in lactating dairy cows that we know of so far. Dr. Gingrich, we talked a little bit about the transferring from birds into mammals. Let's specifically talk, though, in the cattle. And we're talking, and we can get it. That's going to, of course, lead into other conversations about movement and all those kinds of things. But just on farm, I mean, what are the things, how that could be transferred?
Yeah. So initially, we didn't think it could be transferred from cow to cow. But certainly what we're seeing now is that that is happening. They know that just from the way this virus is moving through the herds, introduced into the herds, as well as what we call the genetic sequencing of the virus, which the diagnostic labs do, which shows some changes in the virus that makes it be able to do this. How is it being transferred from cow to cow? That is a great question. I really wish I knew the answer. We don't. We suspect that it could be being transferred in the parlor when cows are being milked. So is that a mechanism of transmission just because the virus is concentrated so much in the milk? Yeah, that could be happening. But I don't think we can rule out other things such as, well, is it being transmitted through the air, like flu viruses are transmitted? Is it being transmitted through the air? And when those cows are in the holding pen or standing real close when they're being milked, is that when the transmissions occurred? So I don't think we can rule out aerosol spread. Certainly cannot rule out other types of spread either mechanical, trucks, people, equipment, things like that, continuing with birds, et cetera. So we're concerned about, is it being spread in the milk cow to cow? But we also have to look at all the other sources as well.
Okay. So when we talk about spread, then that leads us down the subject of the control of movement, or not control of movement as much as knowing what's being moved, and talk about some of the stuff that's coming down with USDA, if you could.
Yeah. So USDA has put in they did a federal order where veterinarians and producers and livestock markets will need to follow those regulations. Number one thing is the movement requirements only affect lactating dairy cows moving across state lines. So this is not affecting calves moving. It's not affecting beef cattle moving or animals in feed yards moving to packing plants. So it's only lactating dairy cows. And they basically, to make it as simple as possible, lactating dairy cows moving direct to slaughter do not need tested, but they do need some type of moving document, a health certificate from a veterinarian. They need official ID in some form, either a back tag or an EID, or certain states also allow ownership or statement. So lactating dairy cows direct to slaughter, no testing. Lactating dairy cows moving across state lines to farms for non-slaughter purposes, so that could be expositions, et cetera. They need to have their milk tested, and it needs to be negative to influenza A, and then they can move. And so that is creating some work for producers, veterinarians, and diagnostic labs. But we do think it's necessary. We have to have some type of restriction on these infected animals moving and identify. If they're infected, we don't want to infect another farm. So we're supportive of those requirements, even though it is certainly creating some anxiety over how we're going to get all that work done.
Yeah. So I think that leads us down the next road of a topic to discuss here, and that is animal traceability. As we know, the USDA here just recently finalizing and releasing their rules on animal traceability, and now requiring those older beef animals that are going to be used for breeding purposes to have an electronic EID tag in their ear. And I guess as a veterinarian yourself representing the American Association of Bovine Practitioners, your thoughts on this?
You know, I mean, I think as a veterinarian and someone who really his entire career has supported the beef and dairy industry, I think that having a robust, safe, and confidential animal movement system is important to every person in this country that raises beef or sells milk. Because, you know, really, we're the, you know, if you look at our beef and dairy industry, I think probably all your listeners think we lead the world. So we should lead the world on this too. And currently we're not. And I think this disease outbreak is a warning sign to our industry that we have got to have a very robust traceability system. Because if this would have been a worse event, like foot and mouth disease, for instance, I really think we'd be in serious trouble right now. So I think this is a warning sign about how we can kind of test a low morbidity, low mortality event and make our system better. And so I'm hoping that we can use this to learn so we are prepared in the event of something worse.
Yeah. So let's switch now and talk about consumer confidence. As ranchers or dairy producers, we're all somewhat in the same pool now because we're dealing with consumers, and they don't care whether the cow's black and white or whether it's all black. It's a cow. And now we're dealing with consumer confidence in products that come from cows. So, you know, your thoughts regarding A, dealing with consumers, but also the products themselves.
Yeah, great question. And that's certainly at the forefront of the messaging from AABP, because, you know, we take an oath as veterinarians, and part of that oath is protecting the public health. And, you know, we want to make sure that the products that farmers are producing and that veterinarians assist them in that production process are safe. And so our messaging from AABP has been drinking pasteurized milk remains safe. Drinking unpasteurized milk is not safe and never has been. The FDA has done over 200 samples tested at a variety of pasteurization temperatures, and they're testing a variety of dairy products. And they have confirmed that pasteurization destroys this virus. Some people may have heard that they picked up retail milk samples and they found what they call fragments of the virus in the milk sample. That's the DNA of the virus. And that makes some people concerned. My message is that shows pasteurization killed it. It destroyed the virus and broke it into a bunch of little bits, and it's no longer infective. So I think that's a good message. Now, you're right. Consumers do not understand that those dairy cows are different than beef cows. They don't. Most of them have no idea that there is a difference, but you know, dairy cows at the end of their life, you know, about 2.7 million of them, you know, become beef cows and are called. And so, you know, the USDA announced that they are looking at ground beef samples and is the virus in ground beef? And the initial testing is that it is not in ground beef. And certainly ground beef is cooked enough that this virus would also be destroyed by any cooking processes, et cetera. So I do think it's important that we look and confirm that meat and beef is still safe to eat. But, you know, certainly the swine industry has gone through influenza outbreaks. The poultry industry has gone through influenza outbreaks. And, you know, we know that pork is safe to eat. We know that eggs are safe to eat. So I am confident that we will get the testing done that confirms that the products we produce, that every rancher and dairy farmer produces, are safe.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about unpasteurized milk. So what does it look like in humans? Should they, you know, if they were to drink milk that was unpasteurized, it has H5N1 in it?
So it's not just consuming the milk. So first, the highest risk population is going to be the people that milk cows, because they're around that milk. And the only human case confirmed so far was a dairy farm employee, and they got conjunctivitis, pink eye. Humans have a lot of influenza A receptors in their eyes. And so that's probably going to be one of the more common signs, is conjunctivitis. But certainly consuming raw milk, unpasteurized milk from an affected cow could cause human illness. And although we don't think flu is a really serious disease in most people, this strain of flu does cause higher risk to humans, influenza A, H5N1. That's why public health officials are concerned. So bottom line, don't drink unpasteurized milk.
All right. Okay. Let's take a break here. When we come back, we got one more segment. My guest today is Dr. Fred Gingrich. He is the executive director of the American Association of Bovine Practitioners. When we come back, we're going to talk some what ifs. When we come back here on the Working Ranch Radio Show.
This year, choose to unlock the full potential of your cattle operation with K-Line Irrigation, the affordable and dynamic solution for grass-based livestock operations. Beat drought by planning ahead with the most user-friendly irrigation system. K-Line systems ensure optimal water distribution across all acres and are unencumbered by obstacles such as fence lines or steep terrain. Don't miss out on untapped pasture potential. Choose K-Line to secure the future of your grazing operation. For more information, visit our website at www.k-linena.com. Be sure to fill out a consultation form so our designers can create an estimate for your project. K-Line Irrigation, for greener, more productive pastures anywhere.
Welcome back to the Working Ranch Radio Show. My guest today is Dr. Fred Gingrich, Executive Director of the American Association of Bovine Practitioners. We're talking about influenza type A, the H5N1 virus that's been confirmed, of course, for many, many years. Avian flu, bird flu, it's called, and now being confirmed in lactating dairy cows. As we've had some great discussion already, if you have missed any of that, I would encourage you to go back to our podcast site at workingranchradio.com and listen to the full interview. Or you can find it on your own podcast provider as well. Dr. Gingrich, I want, before we get into some of the what-ifs that we've talked about, we're going to be going into, real quick from a rancher's side of things, we've talked a little bit about what we should be looking for in these cattle, and with calves, it may look like they're not getting the milk they need and those kinds of things. Specifically, though, another thing that you talked about, and I hadn't thought about this too, is a lot of times we're needing colostrum or we're needing milk. So what if we're in an area that's close to dairies? Well, there's a sure spot to go pick that up. And you're saying might want to hold off on that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Justin. You know, as we're in calving season, if you got an orphan calf or something else happens, That is a practice that is sometimes done to get milk and or colostrum from dairies. It's probably just out of an abundance of caution. I would not do that. You know, certainly we can say, well, some dairies pasteurize that, and that's true. That pasteurization is a little different than is done for the consuming public sometimes. So, you know, out of an abundance of caution, limit what you're bringing onto a ranch that originated from a dairy, because we don't know unless that is tested. So that's probably good. There's great colostrum replacement products out there that should probably be used instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, in fact, as you were talking about that, I remember I did an interview, I think it was back in February of this year, episode 156, with Dr. Travis White with the Saskatoon Colostrum Company. We were talking about the whole bovine colostrum products that are on the market now today. Very good, very effective, and of course, very safe as well. Okay, now let's head down this road of talking about what ifs. And I just want to caution folks again here. I don't want to really get too deep in the weeds in some of this, because I don't like to create unnecessary fear or provide ammunition for conspiracy theories as well. But Dr. Gingrich, what happens if we find it in a beef cow?
Well, you know, I mentioned to you that what ifs are okay because they're about preparing, and we have to prepare so we're not caught off guard. So, you know, what if we find it in a beef cow? So I think the first thing that a rancher should do is that if you suspect that you have a disease, the first person you should call is your veterinarian, 100%, so they can get involved. This is a reportable disease, and your veterinarian will collect samples and submit them to a diagnostic lab. You know, if they are positive, that will trigger a reportable disease event. But we don't want to hide from that, because certainly if you identify this in your farm, you gotta do what's best for the common good here. And the common good is we gotta identify positive herds so we can protect the nation's beef herd and the nation's dairy herd. So we all gotta cooperate and participate in this surveillance program.
Mm-hmm. So somebody has a reported on their ranch. What's gonna happen?
Well, it will be reported to the state veterinarian, and they will be identified as a positive herd. But that is just, you know, basically it's the state information on there. And you'll probably have your local USDA regional veterinarian probably do some epidemiologic surveillance of the herd. But if it acts the same way as it does in dairy cattle, then it's just going to affect 10 to 15% of your animals. And it goes and it peaks at about 2 to 4 days is the number of cases. So if you have 100 mama cows, you can expect about 10 of them to be sick with 10 to 15 within that 2 to 4 day window. And then kind of everything normalizes after 10 to 20 days.
Okay.
And so it comes in hot and heavy, and then it goes away in 2 to 3 weeks. So it's just going to require care for those calves that are nursing if those cows dry up and milk. So, you know, right now it's not been reported in beef cattle, but I do think that we need to be prepared and we need to do the investigations if it is found in the beef herd.
Okay, so to put it in some context or try to understand maybe the severity of this or concern we should have in it, give me on a scale of 1 to 10 where you would think this is at for our cattle industry.
So I'm going to say right now it fits at about like an 8 or a 9. And the only reason I'm saying that, Justin, is because there's so much about this that we don't know. This is a new disease. This is the first time we've had a disease event like this in dairy cattle. Really, you know, we had the BSE outbreak 17 years ago, one herd, all right? And we know what that did to the markets for a long time. But it didn't spread. So the last time we had something like this was over 100 years ago. This is absolutely new territory for everybody that's a veterinarian or a producer right now. Mm-hmm. We have to figure out how it's spread, how we can prevent it, and is there a vaccine that can be made and all these other things. And that's why my level of concern is a bit higher. Mm-hmm. The disease itself, it has an impact on the affected farms. It could be worse, and we're thankful for that. But because we have so much to learn and this is a novel disease event, that's why I think everybody's concern should be elevated.
Okay. Well, and I can see there's so much unknowns, and you kind of referenced that as we had went through our interview here today, then there's studies being done. I can see that elevating the level of it. So real quick, as we kind of wrap up regarding studies, how is that transpiring? Is it kind of an all hands on deck in our industry right now to try to get something figured out?
I think veterinarians, diagnosticians, as well as state agencies and federal agencies like USDA, they're all doing what we call epidemiologic studies on these farms. And there's a lot of interesting data out there. I think the studies have to focus on a few areas. Number one, consumer confidence in meat and milk. We've discussed that. Number two, how is it spread? Very, very important to figure that route of transmission out. Number three, we need good diagnostic tests. Right now, we can test individual animals in their milk, but blood work as well as herd level work, like a bulk tank sample, I think that's going to be very important moving forward. So we need that testing. And then lastly, we need to figure out prevention specifically. Is this a disease that can be vaccinated for to protect the nation's cattle herd? So I think those are the big buckets that we're looking at.
All right. Well, Dr. Gingrich, just one final question, I guess, just to leave it with this, just your overall arching comments or thoughts regarding the impact to our industry.
Well, you know, we're concerned with what's happening in the markets right now on the beef side and certainly on the milk side as well. But I think, you know, long term, we want to try to contain this disease and learn about it. And I think that's what we're looking at right now. That's our levels of concern.
You bet. Well, Dr. Gingrich, thanks for joining us here today. Appreciate the insight, the information on that. A lot to be thinking about, a lot to be watching for, and possibly some real interesting times for our industry ahead. Appreciate you joining us here on the Working Ranch Radio Show.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Appreciate it, Justin.
You bet. And again, my guest today has been Dr. Fred Gingrich, Executive Director of the American Association of Bovine Practitioners. By the way, if you do have more questions you'd like to visit with him about it, you can go to their website at aabp.org is the website, and you can find contact information there. Well, coming up after the break, we're going to switch species. Hey, let's talk about horses, shall we? Feeding ranch horses for spring season. Dr. Karen Davison will be joining us coming up after this. And we welcome you back here to the Working Ranch Radio Show. My guest now is Dr. Karen Davison, who is the Senior Nutritionist and Director of Equine Technical Solutions for Purina Animal Nutrition. And Karen, thanks for joining us here on the Working Ranch Radio Show.
Hi, Justin. Glad to be here.
Well, as you and I were discussing before we went on air, I was just telling you about kind of our situation here in our ranching operation. We're just getting ready to start heading into calving season, and we do utilize horses when we're out calving, amongst other things, but mostly it's we like that element in there. And I was telling you, I was having a conversation with my nephew who works for me, and we had just were commenting the fact that we need to get the ride horses kind of pulled together, everything that we're going to be using for calving this year and summer work. And when we come off of this winter element that a lot of these horses are in. We start looking at, okay, getting these horses into condition, into shape for the spring and the summer. As ranchers, a lot of times we just think, well, let's just throw everything out there that we're doing with the cows. But we need to look at horse and cow mineral supplements and needs just maybe a little bit different. They're not quite the same thing.
Yeah, that's true. Horses and cattle are different. You can tell by the outside, but they're also extremely different on the inside. We joke sometimes. Now, I live in Texas, and we joke sometimes with our horse owners that there should be a little more difference between horse hay and cow hay than just a couple of bucks a bale. It's actually truly different quality hay, because horses just can't extract the same nutrition out of the same hay that a mature cow can. And maybe for lack of a better, more technical explanation, you might at least look at your horses as more of a developing heifer than an old cow. Okay. As far as, feed them more. Yeah, they need some higher quality nutrition than an old cow can manage on. And so, I live in Texas. We have a lot of ranches in South Texas, and what works for a ranch in South Texas is different than a ranch in Montana. And, I guess from the very basis of everything, the biggest difference across all these different ranches to me is forage quality and forage quantity, and how well a horse can manage on just the forage. And there's certain times a year with different activity levels that you can get by with pretty much forage and mineral and salt. But as the forage quality declines, and as your physical demands on the horse go up, so certain times a year when you're riding them more and that kind of thing, then maybe we need to pay a little attention to nutrition. Just a really general point I'd like to get out there is a lot of people say, yeah, I put out mineral for my horses, and they're talking about those trace mineral salt blocks. Mm-hmm. And, those work okay for cattle to get some trace mineral, but mostly they're salt blocks. And I just tell people in general, if it's hard as a salt block, it's a salt block. And, horses' tongues aren't as rough as a cow's tongue, and horses have some different mineral needs. And because I am a bit of a nutrition nerd, I just calculated one time for the heck of it that a horse would have to eat 2 pounds a day of a trace mineral salt block to get their copper requirements met. So probably not what you want to have happening. So again, horses are different than cattle for a lot of different reasons. And there are times a year that maybe a good mineral and a free choice salt and forage may be all they need. But I think, cattle are valuable these days. And I think people are understanding and see that they're worth maybe investing in from a nutrition standpoint to optimize performance and get, return on your investment type of thing. And I kind of look at horses the same way. I wouldn't ask anybody to spend, $3,000 on a $1,200 horse, but the value of a really good broke general ranch horse these days that'll do a job for you, they're hard to replace. Mm-hmm. So maybe nutrition from a, not only just a performance today for this season, but how long I can keep that horse going and not wear them out and use them up. Mm-hmm. And so those are the things we kind of look at.
Well, and as you were talking about that, one of the things that come to my mind is the fact that especially these using horses that we're riding a lot, and we can talk later about nutrition on maybe some brood mares and things like that. But at the same time, these using horses where they're exercising daily, not only getting them into that point, but there's a lot of needs. Just even if we look at our own as a human, if we're exercising daily, there's certain things we're needing. And a horse is no different. A riding horse, a using horse that we're doing, whether it's for pleasure or for ranch work that many of us are doing this time of the year, those two, that's an important part of this as well, knowing that they're exercising, there's certain nutrients and things they're needing as well.
For sure. And I think, if a horse is out, just say on forage or on pasture, and if you're blessed with good pasture and you're keeping those horses fat, that's great. A lot of times, if you're not careful, though, when you get in that season and you start saddling them and riding them every day, especially several hours a day, that fat will melt pretty quick. And if you don't have, again, it's just like we said earlier, like a developing heifer, you can keep her fat on pasture. But boy, if you'll just feed a little extra protein, little good quality protein, little good mineral, it doesn't take a lot. But there are some things missing in pasture or hay only. That and mostly it's a protein quality. And some of these horses we could get by, we have products called ration balancers, where they're just a really highly concentrated, low volume feed. And, a pound a day of a ration balancer like the Purina Enrich Plus is a good ration balancer. And is for horses who are getting enough calories. They're staying fat enough mm-hmm. on hay or pasture, but they're not getting quite the protein quality and the vitamins and minerals they need out of that pasture. And so you can really, you know, and boy, you start riding a horse every day and you lose that muscle mass over their top line and you get your saddle doesn't fit and they get sore backed and they don't want to pull or they don't want to be ridden all day, yeah. all the things. And just a little bit of nutrition can really make a difference for that. So, you know, not looking at like you have to go buy the most expensive high performance feed, but fill in the gaps mm-hmm. and just, you know, and we have people all over the country. That's one of the things that's good with Purina is that we do have people all over the country that are trained that can help you in your region. So again, what we might do for our South Texas ranches might be different than what we would recommend for you based on your forage and your use of your horses in the season.
Mm-hmm. As we look at the different types of horses that folks might have on their ranch and operations, as I was telling you before we went on air, we have a set of riding horses. In addition, you have your brood mares, maybe a stud or two. There's those different elements. You need to consider each of those different types, the nutrient requirements, much like we do with our own cattle, as you said. But again, it's a little bit different with some horses. Let's work through some of those different types that we would see starting first, maybe as we talked about a bit ago, these brood mares or these colts and mares that are out there, and work through the different things on up to these mature horses.
Sure. I've mentioned body fat or body condition, and the body condition scoring system, it was developed by Texas A&M back in the 80s, and it was developed on brood mares. And they have a whole scoring system to tell you how fat or thin a horse is. And just a summary, you can find that whole thing described on purinamills.com if you want. But the bottom line is if a brood mare, if you can see ribs showing on a brood mare, she's not getting enough energy to meet her needs, and that will drastically affect reproductive efficiency. And so first off of all, you know, management of brood mares is keep her in good shape. It doesn't do good to have her thin and gaining. That's kind of an old school thing. A mare needs to stay with her ribs covered year round. And that's even more important when they're lactating. So you got a mare that's got a foal on her side and she's not getting fed to support that level of lactation and she starts dropping condition and you're trying to breed her back, you have a less chance of getting her bred back and getting a foal on the ground next year. And that gets even worse. I was involved in a study many years ago in Kansas on some ranch mares where they didn't feed those mares. They kept them out on pasture and there was just a short period of time that they would feed them a little bit of grain as they were coming up to foal. And the mares that were in their mid to late teens, once they foaled, if they had ribs showing, they were about half as likely as those younger mares to get back in foal. Mm-hmm. And some of those older mares carry some really good genetics and you want to keep her going. You don't, you know, it's just like you don't want to feed a cow that's not going to produce. You don't want to feed a mare that's not going to produce. But goodness, if it's not her fault, you know, if you're mm-hmm. just not feeding her to support it, and a lactating brood mare is the hardest working horse you got. And so the day that foal stands and nurses, her energy requirements and her protein requirements go up nearly double what they were before she foaled. So you got to feed her accordingly. And so that's where it's really important to feed those lactating mares. And again, I wouldn't tell somebody to spend a whole lot of money on a mare that's not raising a foal that's worth much, but you might, if she's worth breeding, she's worth feeding.
Yeah.
You know? So, and I think sometimes people think, my gosh, it's going to cost me $3 million to feed these mares. And we can work with you on that and help you know that probably less than $500 a year, you can get that mare and keep her in good enough shape to raise a foal and have a bigger chance of getting more pregnancies. And then, you know, the baby, they're really well supplied by mare's milk for about the first couple of months of life. And then if you're not supplementing that foal, they will begin to slow their development if mare's milk and grass is all they've got access to. And then what'll happen sometimes is you won't see it until you wean them, because mare's milk will kind of keep them looking pretty good. And then you wean them and they kind of crash and they start looking like, again, this is a highly technical term, but we use it around here, little pot-bellied hairballs, you know, little weanlings and coming yearlings who are just not getting nutrition enough to develop like they should. And not only do they look a little bit ratty, they just, you know, that their bone development, their muscle development is being compromised, and you'll never get that back. Mm-hmm. If you don't help them, then they'll never have the lean tissue and the mass that they would have if you had brought them along. So again, for me, if they're worth being here, it's worth looking at how do we help support that horse to help them grow into the soundest adult that they can.
Yeah, for sure. You had mentioned just a little bit ago the fact that because Purina Animal Nutrition's team, there's a lot of folks all across the country. There is that ability for folks to reach out should you have questions about some of this, matching that up to the needs that you might have, whether it's brood mares, whether it's riding horses for cow work or for recreational use. There's some ways they can reach out and get a hold of your guys' team in terms of talking about here's what we need.
For sure. Yeah, we have at PurinaMills.com. You can always click on Ask the Expert. You send us an email and we will get back with you and we can connect you up with a local salesperson, your local Purina store, feed store. They can always help you find the local salesperson as well. And just, you know, let people know that it's nobody's going to try to sell you something you don't need. That's not helpful for us or you. It's just trying to match what works best for your goals and your budget and what you're trying to get done. And so there's not like a one size fits all, again, because there's just not one ranch horse out there or one ranch situation. So we also have an 800 number, 1-800-227-8941. And those our customer service team, and they're really well trained, but they'll also, if you want to speak to a nutritionist, they'll send you to myself or someone on my team to help just talk through what would be the best plan for you to do. Again, our goal would be to help you achieve your goals.
Mm-hmm. You bet. Dr. Karen Davison, my guest here today, senior nutritionist and director of equine technical solutions for Purina Animal Nutrition. Karen, appreciate you joining us here on the Working Ranch Radio Show.
Thank you, Justin.
You bet. And again, if you do have more questions or would like to know more about the products or just questions regarding nutrition, like Karen said, you can give them a call at that 800 number, or you can head to their website at purinamills.com. Just an awful lot of things there. Not only the products that are available for the different stages of horses, and we all have them, everything from the young ones up to those senior horses, but also educational material and also where you can buy the products locally that are around you. And so as we know, for these next several months and into the fall run, we're going to be using these horses an awful lot. Let's keep them on a good nutritional plane as we do that. Well, stay with us. Coming up next, the Captain Tim O'Byrne will be in with this week's edition of Tim's Two Cents and meteorologist Don Day with a look at our long-term weather. We'll be back after this.
Looking for the perfect gift for a gardener or weather enthusiast? Introducing the Tropo, a precision rain gauge that has revolutionized both reliability and convenience. Expertly engineered by meteorologists, the Tropo gauge boasts rugged durability, impeccable accuracy, and precision to the hundredth of an inch. Visit measurerain.com to order a Tropo today and use code RAINDAY, that's RAINDAY, for free shipping and 10% off. Go to measurerain.com.
Hey, Justin. Hey, everybody out there in Working Ranch Radioland. We're heavy duty into the work now, and it's not going to slow down till the fall. I want you folks to play safe out there, okay? Do your machinery walk-arounds and your checks. Get your cowboy gear fixed and ready to go, and don't take any chances. Take it easy. And one of my pet peeves, and I just saw another person on social media, a horse trainer gal, she came on and said, whatever you do, you people, don't ride horses in sneakers. And that is a pet peeve of mine. There's a reason why us professional cowboys use a custom boot with an underslung heel, shank, and a thin sole. The sole is slippery and not wide like a farmer boot, these big treaded boots that you see a lot of people wearing. And if a horse rolls on you, you can get out of it really easy. The underslung heel is there so that the boot does not go through the stirrup. And of course, the shank is there to take the pressure off your insole. So these are all reasons why you wear the proper boots when you're riding horses. Okay, that's very, very important. Now, we're out in the rural areas. Emergency response time is 10 times longer than it would be on a good day in the urban areas. So we have to keep all that into consideration. Be safe out there. Back to you in the booth.
All right. Thanks, Captain. Some good advice there. And it really doesn't matter whether you're riding a dog gentle broke horse or whether it's a green broke horse. Some very good advice from the captain. Well, as we switch gears a bit and turn and take a look at our long-term weather, meteorologist Don Day is standing by. And Don, as you and I were, we were joking before we went on air here just about don't trust your phone. Weather, and nothing against any of the weather apps. We all like them. We all need them. And at the same time, when you start looking out 7 to 10 days on these apps, especially this time of the year, it's probably going to change.
That's right. I mean, you do need to use some judgment when you use those forecast tools. And that's how you kind of have to view whether you're using your phone or you're going online to get a weather forecast and you're looking at that long range forecast. You have to frame the time of year you're in. You know, that long range forecast in the dead part of winter, when you're fully in the middle of winter, or conversely, if you're in the middle of summer. Mm-hmm. But when you go into these transition months between seasons, literally, it's chaos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and then trying to put numbers and computing power to chaos leads to a lot of high variability day to day in your weather forecast. And so you have to be very measured in your approach. You have to use some discernment in terms of when you use weather information.
Yeah. Well, and it is unsettled, as in our neck of the woods, it's been awful windy. But I also see in the next 7 to 10 days, you got weather as far up into southern Canada, as clear down into New Mexico and Arizona, that's showing weather, wind, and all sorts of things.
Yeah, we've got everything but the kitchen sink. And, you know, we have to say, you know, a lot of the severe weather here over the last couple of weeks. I mean, we started the tornado season slowly. And then, boy, here over the last couple of weeks, we're just seeing this huge increase. And everyone's seen the videos and heard about the stories of the tornadoes in Nebraska and Kansas and Oklahoma. And so we've seen an uptick in severe weather, which means we're still seeing a lot of storminess come off the Pacific and going across the United States. And really over the next week or two, I think what we're going to see is a very active pattern coast to coast, a wide variety of weather. We're still going to have snow in parts of the Northern Plains and Rockies as a possibility. We're going to see, as you mentioned, a lot of wind, especially in the central and southern plains. This is something in the week ahead that we're going to be experiencing. And this also means more severe weather will be found across the Midwest and southern plains. And we're going to see a wide variety of temperatures. I think we have said in earlier podcasts, you got to get past that Mother's Day weekend before you can really start to maybe see some stability in the weather in spring. And I think that's really going to be true.
Mm-hmm. Do we continue to see some moisture, though, decent moisture moving across the country?
Yeah, we certainly will. And I think what you're going to see is that the areas that have been drier, and that would be the southwestern United States and part of that I-70 corridor area into the southern plains, even the southern plains, even that I-70 corridor, I think is in line to be picking up some precipitation. So really, there will be very few areas of the United States not affected by this stormy weather.
All right. Well, just to let listeners know before you head out here today, next week, as you and I talked off air, you're going to be joining us for the full entire show as we're going to be taking a look at the extended long-term look at our weather the rest of the spring and looking into summer and fall as well. So thanks for joining us this week and look forward to talking to you next week.
See you then.
And again, that is meteorologist Don Day with a look at our long-term weather. You can find his podcast site at dayweather.com. And like we just mentioned there, he's going to be joining us. That'll be our featured topic for next week's Working Ranch Radio Show. Stay with us. We'll put a wrap on this week's edition when we return on the Working Ranch Radio Show. Hey, thanks for joining us on our program here today. By the way, if you're listening on a podcast provider of some sort, leave us a comment or leave us a rating. And if you do want to get a hold of me, my email address is justin.workingranch@gmail.com. Well, the Working Ranch Radio Show is a production of Working Ranch Magazine, branded number one by America's Ranchers. Thanks for joining us. I'm Justin Mills. And until next time, keep your chin down and your mind in the middle. So long.